This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. In Kathy Reich's latest novel, forensic anthropologist Temperance Brennan comes upon two sets of very old bones from Israel, bones that some would prefer she just leave alone. Bones are nothing new to Tempe Brennan, nor to author Kathy Reich's. In her 8 Tempe Brennan novels, Kathy Reich's has woven plots straight out of her own career as a forensic anthropologist for the state of North Carolina and for the province of Quebec. Bones are Kathy Reich's expertise and often the key to unraveling mysteries both in real life and in fiction. Kathy Reich's latest novel takes her character, Tempe Brennan, to Israel. It is called Crossbones, and Kathy Reich's is here in the studio. Welcome to The State of Things.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. I understand that your books, all your books, have grown out of an incident at some point or other in your career as a forensic anthropologist. What was it that gave you the idea for Crossbones? Had you actually come across bones from Israel?
Well, Crossbones started out very differently from my other books. They start with a case I've worked on, a serial murder case or a cult or biker wars or whatever it is I've been involved in. Crossbones, I guess I started about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. I was approached by a colleague at UNC Charlotte, James Tabor, who is a biblical archaeologist. And he said, I've been working in Israel for 35 years, and I've got some facts that might interest you for a Tempe Brennan story. So I met with James, and he showed me an old black and white photo of a skeleton lying in place in a cave. And he said that picture was taken during the 1963 excavation at Masada. 25 skeletons were found in a cave over the wall from the top of the site. Masada, of course, is this summit where Jewish zealots held out in a first century rebellion. And when the Romans finally broke through, they found everyone, all 960 people, were dead. But below the summit, in this little cave, were found these 25 skeletons. And even though massive publication, massive amounts of media coverage came out of the Masada excavations, nothing was ever reported on these skeletons. My researcher, Dr. Tabor, managed to get the original field notes from the physical anthropologist who analyzed the material, and he was noted for his publications, very detailed. He never published on any of this material. And it was clear from his notes he never saw this complete articulated skeleton. So right away, that was a good enough story for me. Who is this skeleton, and who were these people that were found in this cave at Masada? Why were they separate from the main zealot population at Masada? But James also had information on the James ossuary, which has been in the news in recent years. This is a small stone box. The burial custom among Israeli Jews in the first century was to put the body in the tomb, allow it to decompose for a year, then gather the bones and put them in a small stone box known as an ossuary. So this ossuary came to public attention in late 1999, and it's very controversial because inscribed on it are the words, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. The Israeli Antiquity Authority put together a committee to study the box, and everyone agrees, it's authentic first century. Where the experts are split is whether the inscription is authentic. If, in fact, it's authentic, it held the brother of Jesus, James, known as James the Just, who ran the early church in Jerusalem after the death of Christ. So, okay, that sounded good, too. Let's weave this into the story. But it gets better. Dr. Tabor was in, there are two valleys outside Jerusalem, the Hinnom and the Kidron Valleys. He was hiking with students in the spring of 2000, shortly after this ossuary was announced to the public, and found a recently looted tomb. For a lot of details I can't go into, he is persuaded that it's very, very possible the James ossuary came from this tomb, which would make it the Jesus family tomb. In that tomb, in the lower level, he and his students found a shroud. This one's legitimately dated to the first century. It's not like the shroud.
The tests have shown that it is.
Carbon-14 dating. It's the real deal. In that shroud, they found bones. They have got DNA from those bones. There is bony material from the James ossuary. They have requested permission to do DNA comparisons between the two, and the Israeli government repeatedly refuses.
Now, why do they refuse?
It's unclear as to why they won't allow that. So you've got all of these different, what I did is I took real archaeological facts, things that exist, the tomb, the shroud, the skeletons from Masada, the ossuary, and I wove those into a story.
One thing that comes out in your story, and this it touches on your expertise very much, in bones, would be if one could do DNA testing on what is in the shroud and what is in this box.
Right.
You could determine if those two people are related.
Exactly.
So you could determine if those bones in the shroud were, could be, a brother of James, could be those of Jesus.
What you could do is, and DNA has been done on the bones from the shroud, from the tomb. If there was a link to the bones in the James ossuary, and if that ossuary is authenticated, if the inscription is real, then you have, in fact, tied that ossuary to that tomb, and you can show that the person in the ossuary is related to the persons in the tomb, and therefore you've very possibly located the Jesus family tomb.
Mm-hmm. How common of names were Jesus and James at that time?
They were relatively common, but when you do, and I go into this in the story, but when you run the statistical probability, this isn't the only ossuary found in this collection. There was also a couple of Miriams, and there was a Jude, and there was a Matthew. But if you run the possibility, the statistical probability of finding all those together in the same tomb, it becomes very, very improbable that it's anything other than the Jesus family group.
Mm-hmm. And so your storyline here has your character, Tempe Brennan, who comes upon this story, and now she's in Israel, and she's trying to find, do the determination, the DNA and the rest, and is thwarted in this. And you make the case here that it's because some people may not want this to be revealed.
Yeah, it becomes clear that somebody doesn't want this skeleton to resurface. First of all, what happened to this complete skeleton from Masada? Where did it go? Why wasn't it ever seen by the physical anthropologist? Was it spirited out of Israel? And there is a book that was written back in the 70s that suggested exactly this, that these things were spirited away because the Israelis or whoever didn't want them to come to public attention.
Yeah, the reason for that, if you could clarify for us, because we hear the story about the Jesus bones, if those were determined to be those of Jesus, that would certainly undercut the resurrection story about Jesus' entire body ascends.
Absolutely.
To heaven. But what would the issue be with the other set of bones that you're talking about here at Masada? Well, why would that be confrontational? Why would that be something that the Israeli government wouldn't want found out?
Well, and that's what Tempe can't figure out, is who is it that doesn't want these to resurface? Is it Orthodox Jews in Israel? Because that would somewhat change the interpretation of what went on at Masada. If you had early Christians, early Jesus followers up on Masada, what are they doing up there? This is Judaism's sacred emblem, this site. It's supposed to be all Jewish zealots up there. What if you've got another group living up there in this cave? Archaeological materials found with the bones in the cave suggest people were living there. All right, so perhaps you've got some ultra-extremist Orthodox Jews that don't want it to be surfaced. What if it's radical Muslims that are trying to get hold of this skeleton, that they can use it for media purposes or to undermine belief in traditional Christian interpretations? What if it's ultra-conservative Christians that are trying to get hold of it because they don't want it to surface because it will throw questions on traditional Christian interpretation? So it's unclear who wants this skeleton.
This brings to mind, of course, The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, I've heard of that book. I think he
you
sold
even
a
mentioned
few copies. Well, we made a concerted effort, the Da Vinci, and I can't remember, I started this, you know, 2.5 years ago. I don't remember exactly when Da Vinci Code was released, but it became clear in the writing of this book that while I'm dealing with very different kinds of things, I'm dealing with archaeological evidence, concrete artifacts that exist, and he's dealing with parchments and documents and paintings, but we're touching on similar topics. So my editor and I thought about this and made a, do we mention it? Do we acknowledge that? So we did make the decision that Tempe would acknowledge that this other book exists. And she's saying to herself, you know, could I possibly be being drawn into a situation similar to that?
Yeah. Of course, with the Da Vinci Code, the publication of that book sparked a backlash publication of those who were trying to debunk and take shots at a lot of what the Da Vinci Code is based on.
Exactly.
Do you expect such a backlash to Crossbones?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm sure there are going to be people that will be offended. I've tried to be an equal opportunity offender and offend all the major religious groups, or at least the more radical extremist interpretations of the major religious themes in the world. There will be a book, James Tabor, who acted as my researcher throughout this, because he knows a great deal more about biblical archaeology than I do. He will be publishing a book next spring called The Jesus Family Dynasty, and it will explain all of the facts I've listed at the back of Crossbones, all of the physical evidence that exists in these facts that I used and twisted around to make up a fictional storyline. But Dr. Tabor will be publishing a book at length on all of those actual archaeological discoveries.
Are you religious yourself?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm open-minded. I don't know that I'd say I'm particularly religious, or I was born and raised Roman Catholic, but I don't particularly think of myself as belonging to any one religious institution.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Kathy Reichs, the author now of 8 Temperance Brennan novels. They are based on her work as a forensic anthropologist. So this is a case of trying to solve a mystery of not somebody who died in within our lifetimes, but way, way back.
Well, like a lot of my books, there are two different storylines that are operating. Crossbones begins with the death of a gentleman in Montreal and of a gunshot wound. And unfortunately, this gentleman died while trapped in a closet with his cats. I won't go into the details of what that does, but I would recommend that if you're not feeling well and you have pets, you might want to keep their bowl full, because when desperate, they will begin to munch. So Tempe's brought into the case, and as she's leaving the autopsy, she's approached by a gentleman who hands her a black and white photo of a skeleton and says, "This is why the gentleman is dead."
And so the story of Crossbones is set in motion. Kathy Reichs is with us. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. 1-877-962-9862. If you have a question about her novels or about forensic anthropology, about telling stories from bones, this is your chance. 1-877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are talking today with author Kathy Reichs. Her latest novel is Crossbones. It is the 8th in her series of mysteries based on the character Tempe Brennan, who, like Kathy Reichs, divides her time between Charlotte and Montreal as forensic anthropologist for North Carolina and for the province of Quebec. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Let's go to the phones right now. Marie joins us from Cary. Hi there, Marie.
Hello.
Hi.
I just want to thank you for the colorful images that you bring from Montreal. Being an ex-Montrealer myself, having lived in the ghetto at McGill, and now residing in Cary, North Carolina, it's a real treasure to see those images come to life in a book.
Oh, well, thank you. Do you really recall with fondness the winter images that I've created?
I do. Not that I miss them that much. It's just, it is a special place. I envy your situation of being able to travel between the two areas so frequently. It's truly a magical place. You know, you don't put down the French people. It's very, very well done, so thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Merci.
Marie, thank you for your call. 1-877-962-9862. So how did you get this arrangement of living between these two places?
Oh, I went to Montreal on a national faculty exchange, NFE, where a professor from one university changes places with a professor from another. And I taught at McGill and at Concordia. And while there, the forensic lab, was looking for someone who could work in French and was board certified, because that's becoming very important in all of the forensic sciences, and they recognize the importance of that. And I think there was a pool of one, and I got the job. And at the end of that year, we just struck up this arrangement whereby I would go back and forth every 5 or 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing work in forensic anthropology in North Carolina anymore? Or?
Not, no.
What kind of work would you do here in North
exactly
Carolina?
The same kind of work.
Yeah.
When a case comes into the coroner, the medical examiner, and it's compromised, the body is burned, mummified, decomposed, dismembered, mutilated, skeletal, so you might have a question of ID. Who is it? Now, I don't do very many positive IDs. Those are dental records, maybe DNA. But before you can use dental records or DNA, you have to have a name. You have to know whose dentist to go to. You have to know whose family to go to for comparative samples. So with a complete unknown, I provide detectives with age, sex, race, height, any medical history I can get from the bones. They can then go to their missing persons lists, get a name, and then you can go get antemortem records. The other question I address very frequently is trauma analysis Again, if the body's compromised and a normal autopsy can't figure out what was the manner of death. I will look at bones for bullet entrances or exits, bludgeoning, strangulation, sharp instrument trauma, anything that could tell us something about the manner of death or perhaps about the treatment of the body after death.
Did you set out wanting to do crime lab work?
No, I set out planning to be an archaeologist, and I trained to do that, and I was very happily doing that. But since I was the local bones lady, and again, it was in a time before board certification wasn't as formalized and as recognized, and that's very important now because we testify in court, and it's important to know who is a legitimate forensic expert with the popularity of CSI and all of these shows. A lot of people who have looked at a few bones or a few bugs or hanging up their shingle and saying, I'm a forensic entomologist or a forensic anthropologist or whatever. So it's important to know who's legit. So board certification is important. But back then, that didn't exist. So when police would find bones, they would just take them to me because I was the local bones expert. Mm-hmm. But a physical anthropologist is not the same as a forensic anthropologist.
I wonder what kind of transition you had to make and steel yourself for that job, because I'm imagining the archaeology you might have done before was dried old bones.
Exactly.
And nothing, how would I put it technically, gross.
None of the icky stuff, yeah.
And then you're getting to things in having read a couple of your books where, yeah, you know, maggots are
maggots are us, yes.
They're a fact of life or death.
Absolutely, and they're very useful. Maggots can tell you many things. How long the person's been dead, whether the body's been moved, whether the dead person was a chronic drug user. It's a lot of good stuff in maggots.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to the
you look skeptical.
Well, I'll take your word for that. I just don't know if I could steal. You're a stronger woman than I am. Let's go to the phones. Carl is in High Point. Hi there, Carl.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show. My question was, when you're researching things, how do you kind of keep abreast of technology that's developing so that by the time it gets into print form in your book, it hasn't become obsolete with a new procedure?
One of the big advantages I have, Carl, is that I work in the field, and I am in the crime lab or at the crime scene on a regular basis. So I have the advantage that when I use science that's not my own, such as entomology or blood spatter pattern analysis or mitochondrial DNA analysis, I can just walk across the hall and sit down with one of my colleagues and look at the apparatus, go through the procedure step by step. Or I can pick up the phone and call one of my colleagues and say, walk me through how you extract drugs, for example, from maggots. So that's a big advantage that I have. I don't let anyone read my manuscripts until I submit them to my editor, with one exception, and that is the few pages or paragraphs I write on a particular scientific procedure. I will send those to whoever's been advising me, to my expert, and that person will read them for me to make sure that I haven't made any really stupid mistakes.
Carl, does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Do you ever catch things like that when you're watching television programs? Because there have been so many shows lately.
All the time.
Yeah, and you catch them in a
detail? Oh, all the time.
Detail?
And when I'm reading crime fiction where they've tried to use forensics and they're not a forensic expert and they just haven't gotten it quite right, you notice that.
Yeah. 1-877-962-9862. Kathy Reichs, the author from Charlotte and Montreal, is with us. 1-877-962-9862. And Charles is in Greensboro. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for your shows today and what you're discussing. It should be mentioned, though, that Jewish law is overriding Israeli law or any government decisions, and that within traditional Jewish law you do not disturb a burial or bones, et cetera, unless it's exceptional case, for example, a crime that may have been committed. But I know you know that, it becomes problematic when Jewish law is initiated to, in fact, perform the kind of forensic evidence through archaeological, anthropological digs.
Right, and
I mentioned.
I do talk about the Hevrat Kadisha, which is the group in the ultra-Orthodox group in Israel that is opposed to any form of archaeological excavation. But I'm also talking about an issue in which a box has come to the attention of the public. This box is allegedly been in the possession of an antiquities dealer for 30 years. The box has probably recently been looted from a tomb, and there is bony material in that box.
This is the James ossuary.
Yes, the James ossuary. So if it is a question of extreme archaeological and historic importance, I would encourage that they do allow the DNA testing. And it takes such a very, very small fragment of this material. Mm-hmm. But thank you for your comments.
And Charles, does that answer your question?
Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your call. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Well, in your book, Crossbones, faith and technology are meeting there because the DNA testing might be done on these bones that do exist in real life, not just in your novel.
Right.
That they might be done. Can they determine who somebody is, or is it a case they can rule out who somebody wasn't?
No, they can't do that because you have no comparative sample. What you can do is determine that there are links between individuals using mitochondrial DNA, and the reason you're using that, they've requested to use mitochondrial DNA and have done that type of testing on some, is that with old bone material, your probabilities of extracting it are much greater because mitochondrial DNA exists in hundreds of copies per cell, whereas nuclear DNA, there's only one copy per cell. And mitochondrial DNA is transmitted only through female lines. You get it all from your mother and none from your father. So what it can show is maternal linkages. In other words, family linkages, people who are related through one particular female. So you can't, there is some research going on right now with nuclear DNA, which would allow you to predict characteristics. Say you've got a crime scene and you've got a sample, bodily fluids or whatever, and you have no clue who the perpetrator is. They're working on techniques to be able to predict what was someone who was of African ancestry or European ancestry or Asian ancestry, to predict the color of the eyes, that sort of thing. But that's very much in its infancy. Right now, DNA is used from a forensic point of view for comparative analysis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the mitochondrial, as you say, is the kind of thing that could tell you if these people are related. And
exactly.
It's much more, it exists much more, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of years later. You can have a better chance of finding that
exactly.
than the
yeah.
other. So things, is so much of the story that things may not be as they appear?
Well, you
and
know,
can you use science
exactly.
to sort that out?
What I do is I start with these facts, and this is how I start every story, and then you go, what if? Well, what if this or what if that? So you weave a fictional adventure mm-hmm. using the what if proposition.
Mm-hmm. How much of the Temperance Brennan character is like you? This is the woman who is a forensic anthropologist, lives in Charlotte, lives in Montreal.
Yeah, you noticed those parallels.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's easier than making this stuff up, right? Professionally, she's exactly what I do. You know, she works in crime labs here and there. She's involved in a number of different situations. She's gone off and done some human rights work. So each of my storylines draws on something I've done. So Tempe's obviously involved in something that I've done. In terms of her personal life, she's estranged from her husband, and she's got a difficult daughter. And she's a recovering alcoholic. So all of that is strictly Tempe's. I wanted the character to have these flaws. And obviously, I mean, I couldn't draw those from myself, right? And I wanted the character to have a sense of humor. I wanted her to be approachable. I didn't want her to be one of these super woman type of cool, aloof, unapproachable characters. So hopefully, and I'm told, my friends tell me that when they hear Tempe say these kind of smart-ass things, that they can hear that sense of humor coming straight from me.
Mm-hmm. So what made you turn to writing fiction? Because this was your background is entirely in science. It's what
right.
you did for all your degrees. It's what you did professionally
right.
for decades.
Right. And I've published textbooks and journal articles. And I thought it would be fun. It's as simple as that. I thought it would be fun. I thought it would be a way to share my science with a broader audience. That certainly worked out. I think the books are now in 32 languages around the world. And I'd made full professor at the university, and I could pretty much do what I felt like doing. I thought I'd try something different. You know, when you write a novel in the English department, you're a hero. But if you write a novel in a science department, you're sort of suspect. So I thought it would be fun, and I wrote it completely in secret. It took me 2 years. And
in secret?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't tell anyone. My family knew I was writing it, but I didn't talk about it at the university, and I didn't show it to anyone until it was completely finished. And then I just mailed it off to a publisher.
And the rest, I mean, they just accepted publisher, and that was it?
I had told myself I'd take 50 rejects, and if I got 50 reject slips, I'd consider that a commentary on my writing and go back to my day job, jobs. And the first publisher I sent it to bought it.
So what was the, I'm trying to sleuth out the impetus to write this, is it because a lot of your work was in the lab? And you get to write this character who not only does the work in the lab, because we see a lot of those scenes in the Tempe Brennan novels, but she also goes out into the field, which gather you don't go out into the field as much.
Well, I do go to crime scenes. I don't do what Tempe does. I don't go off on my own digging up bodies or interviewing suspects. But I had just finished, in 1994, I had just finished working on a serial murder case in Montreal. So I had, the court was finished, all the appeals were finished. So I had the storyline in mind, and I had the opportunity, since I was freer, to try something that I wanted to. So it all just kind of came together at that point, and I sat down during spring break of 94 and just outlined chapter by chapter a book, and then I just, in a very linear fashion, I just started writing away at it.
And that was Déjà Dead.
That was Déjà Dead, and that one went straight to the New York Times bestseller list. It's there's a scene in the TV show we're working on now based on the book in which Tempe is told that her book has gone to the New York Times list, and she goes, number three, that's good, right, on the Times? That's pretty good, right? I mean, she hasn't a clue about...
Did you have a clue at the time?
Oh, I knew the New York Times was a good thing, yes.
Well, let's talk a bit about that. You have, there's this program coming up on Fox in the fall called Bones.
Right.
And I want to get this straight. The TV show would have a forensic anthropologist, Tempe Brennan, who you've written about, the fictional character in your books, and she is doing her forensic anthropology thing. She's, you know, she's sleuthing out cases. Mm-hmm. Then she goes home at night and she writes, and she has a character in her books called Kathy Rikes.
Yeah, her fictional character is Kathy Rikes.
Was that your idea?
No, that was the idea of our head writer. Hart Hansen came up with that. He's one of our executive producers and a head writer at Fox. So we hope my readers will feel like they're kind of in on an inside joke with this 180 flip around thing. And throughout the episodes, her staff that works with her is always giving her a hard time about, well, you know, what's in the book, or is this character based on me? And they're always ribbing her about the book.
So the character that she writes about when she goes home and has some spare time to write, the character you write about, Kathy Rikes, you write about Tempe Brennan, and she is this divorced woman who is a recovering alcoholic.
Right.
What is Tempe Brennan going to write about Kathy Rikes? What's her personal life going
to
be like?
I'm not sure yet. We're going to have to wait and see how that develops. But they have a mock-up. The props people made a book with the book cover with the obligatory author photo holding up the skull on the back, and it's called Bread in the Bone by Temperance Brennan. And it's about this fictional anthropologist named Kathy Reich. So it's sort of this mirrors into mirrors kind of thing. But each of the episodes is going to be an original story. None of the episodes on Bones is based on any of my books. So it's a different manifestation of Tempe. It's set in Washington, D.C. She works at, we couldn't get permission to use the Smithsonian, so she works at the Jeffersonian Institution. And they send her out. They loan her out to the FBI. So she's always getting sent out to different. The thing that appealed to Barry Josephson, our executive producer, was that Tempe could be taken into lots of different contexts, and she's not tied to one workplace or situation. Mm-hmm. So she'll be working with an FBI agent who's kind of the parallel of the Ryan character in my book. His name is Seeley Booth, and he's played by David Boreanaz, who spent 7 years as a vampire on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then Angel. So he makes a wonderful FBI agent. So there'll also be a lot of chemistry between the two main characters.
But it's no Montreal connection, no North Carolina connection?
No, or? She may come to North Carolina. She may go to Montreal, but it's not based in either of those places.
Are those places central to the Tempe character, though?
They are central to the Tempe books. But now we're going to have the Tempe TV show. So that's, again, just another whole arena in which you can... It's based on the concept of Tempe. And Emily was just doing an interview that I read. It was reprinted on Emily Deschanel plays Tempe. And she said, I feel like my name is Temperance Brennan. The role I play is Temperance Brennan, but I'm really playing Kathy Reichs, because she feels like she's really playing this real forensic anthropologist who writes fictional novels.
Right. And this is starting in the fall, is that right?
Yeah, it'll be on Fox on Tuesdays at 8. Mm-hmm. Right before a show called House, and then at mid-season we move to 9, and we'll be right after American Idol.
Are you working on another novel?
I am working on another novel. Book 9 will take place in the Carolinas. A little behind on it because my Charlotte to Montreal has now become a triangle with Charlotte, Los Angeles, Montreal to work on the TV show. It'll take place in Charleston. UNCC offers a little two-week field school in May, and I used to teach the primate behavior field school. I'd take my students down to an island off of Beaufort, which is featured in my second book, Death du Jour, and my colleague, the archaeologist, would teach an archaeology field school. Well, the ninth book is going to open up. The archaeologist on staff has left unexpectedly, leaving the field school uncovered, so the chair of the department asks Tempe to please cover this field school. So she's down in Charleston. They're digging a site on Dewey's Island, a prehistoric site, and they discover some remains that are clearly not prehistoric.
We'll have to wait for that book, but we'll continue our conversation with author Kathy Reichs. Her latest novel, her eighth, is called Crossbones. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. More of our conversation with Kathy Reichs coming up on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkova. We are talking today with Kathy Reichs, forensic anthropologist for North Carolina and for the province of Quebec. She lives in Charlotte and Montreal and is author of 8 mystery novels based on her career as told through the character Temperance Brennan. Her latest book is Crossbones, and in it, Kathy Reichs takes Tempe Brennan to the Holy Land. We welcome your calls at 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Teresa joins us in Sanford. Hi there, Teresa. Hello, Teresa?
This is Teresa.
Hi there. Welcome to the program. Did you have a question for Kathy Reichs?
Yes. I was wondering if Mrs. Reich used the Bible to read about her research for the book.
I did use the Bible. If you'll notice at the beginning, there's a quote from both the Old Testament and the New Testament. I also went to Israel, spent a couple of weeks there last March, visiting archaeological sites and crawling around in tombs and drinking copious quantities of bad tea with antiquities dealers. I met with the Israeli National Police. I toured the Israeli National Forensics Labs. I worked with experts at Hadassah University. So hopefully I got a pretty good sense of the place.
Mm-hmm. What of those who would say that the Bible has said everything that needs to be said about Jesus? And that, you know, you're in here and rattling some bones here.
Well, the Bible was written by people. It's an interpretation. The Quran was written by people. It's an interpretation. Old Testament as well. So I drew on all of those for the storyline.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. In your books, the 8 books with Tempe Brennan, we get a lot of subplots about her family life and so forth. As we mentioned before, she's going through a divorce. She gets divorced. She's a recovering alcoholic. She has the love interest throughout,
right,
is Andrew Ryan. How would you describe that relationship? Because it has certainly developed over...
It's on again, off again, hot again, cold again. They have problems. But I will say this, Ryan is there in Israel because he is brought into the investigation of the gentleman that the book starts out with a murder, it turns out, in Montreal. And this murdered gentleman was an antiquities dealer. And as the story unfolds, it becomes clear that he was involved in trading some antiquities that had less than legitimate authentication or less than legitimate means, reasons for being taken out of the Holy Land. So Ryan is brought into the case to investigate that murder and ultimately ends up going to Israel with Tempe, who's going there to investigate the skeleton.
Is it a challenge to imagine a single woman's life? You yourself are married.
Well, true, with three kids, although my kids are grown now. No, I don't think it's difficult to imagine it. I think a lot of married women imagine what it would be like to be single.
And you just get to write about it.
And I get to write about it, yeah.
You know, you mentioned a moment ago the antiquities dealers and dealing with them. I have to wonder if that's an extra level of raising questions about what you are dealing with. If you're a forensic anthropologist and you're trying to suss out who might these bones have belonged to when they walked the earth? Because there are unscrupulous antiquities dealers.
Oh, of course there are.
Because you don't know what they might be trying to sell.
Exactly. Or even if they thought they had the legitimate thing, what they might be trying to sell. I think there are some legitimate antiquities dealers. But you cannot take certain categories of antiquities out of Israel. They simply cannot be removed from Israel. These ossuaries had, if anything is obtained, I think within the last 25 years, sometime in the 70s, it has to have pre-existed those antiquities laws. Otherwise, it's illegal to trade in them. Hmm. So any trade in antiquities from certain locations is illegal.
Okay. Maggie joins us now from Greenville. Hi there, Maggie.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask, Tempe and CSI, et cetera, all rely on DNA as being infallible. And I was wondering if the fact that or supposedly the fact that chimeras have two sets of DNA, if that affects any of the storylines at all.
I haven't used that in a storyline. I have used in my third book, Identical Twins, who have identical DNA. And that was based on an actual situation of a bombing of biker gangs in Montreal where these bikers were blown to bits. So I use that in the story as identical twins, so it's kind of the same idea. Chimeras would be so, and I don't know the statistical.
Can you explain chimeras to the rest of us?
Well, no, I'm not sure I actually can. It's where you've got, perhaps the caller could do this better than I can.
Well, they had a program on television, and a chimera apparently is supposed to have two sets of DNA instead of one, so that one of the pictures they showed had a pigmentation line which was distinctly different from a different pigmentation line on the other half of the body. It was this if it were bisected.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so in other words, you could tell this person had this chimera just by looking at them because they would not...
Well, I mean, they said that you could. I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, I would really... refer that question to a geneticist who would know more about it, but that's the kind of thing that makes a wonderful twist that you can throw into a plot, and it is the kind of thing that I could possibly use in some future storyline I haven't as yet.
Maggie, thank you for your call. We go now to Mike, who's in Raleigh. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I didn't catch the first part of the program, so I don't know if this has came up, but I've read several of Patricia Cornwell's novels, and I was just wondering if there are any parallels in your life personally and hers, or if there's any parallels in your writing style and her writing style.
I think the only parallel is that we both center our characters in a medical examiner system. Other than that, there really isn't. Kay Scarpetta, Patsy Cornwell's character, is a pathologist. My character is an anthropologist. As far as our personal lives, I don't think so. I am a forensic scientist. She is not. She spent some time in the Virginia Medical Examiner's office, but she is not a forensic scientist. She has a degree in English from Davidson College, as a matter of fact, I believe. So, and as far as her personal life, I don't know that much about it, but I don't think there are that many parallels between us.
Does that answer your question, Mike?
Yes.
Okay, thanks so much. 1-877-962-9862. You taught for a bit at Davidson, did you not?
I did for 2 years.
I had another question about something else I saw in your resume, that you taught at the prison in Joliet,
Illinois. Joliet, Illinois. It's a maximum security prison. I did that. My first job was at Northern Illinois University, and they were involved in an off-campus program. Any faculty, basically, that were willing to go in there would teach courses, and prisoners could work towards a degree in, like, a Bachelor of Social Sciences. So they'd get some economics, they'd get some political science, and so I thought I would do that. The first time I ever taught there, I taught primate behavior, and I went in and I was telling these guys about aggression and dominance hierarchies, and they looked at me. But
they could put a name on it now.
Yeah. So I continued to do that for about 4 years as an offload teaching responsibility.
Kathy Rikes is our guest this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Her latest novel, her eighth novel in the Temperance Brennan series, is called Crossbones, and it centers on bones found in Israel, two sets of bones, and just whose they might be. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Kevin's with us from Greensboro. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I had a question. You had mentioned earlier about the research that was used in the latest novel about the ossuary that's found and the bones that were found, or the bone fragments that were found in that, and also in the tomb where there was a shroud found. And I was wondering, you had mentioned the connection that there might be some evidence that this might be the Jesus family tomb, and you could do research to find out if the two sets of bones are related. And there was some discussion about whether those bones might belong to Jesus. And I was wondering, because the gospel accounts seem to indicate that it had more than one brother.
Okay, your phone is breaking up, but I think your question was, there are historical indications that Jesus may have had more than one brother.
Right. There are alternative interpretations of the Jesus family, but other than, I believe, the Roman Catholic interpretations are that the five brothers and two sisters, I think, were later children of Mary and Joseph, which would make Jesus the oldest and born to Mary as a virgin, or that they were pre-existing children of Joseph, which would make Jesus perhaps the youngest and still the child of Mary the Virgin. So
even if Mary had children before?
Joseph would have had children before by someone else.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
There's also an interpretation that they were cousins and not direct siblings. So there are different interpretations, but it's historically documented these people existed. And James, who was known as James the Just, did take over the early Christian movement in Jerusalem and ran the church in Jerusalem following the death of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any trepidation in taking on this issue?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course I do. And I still do. There are going to be people that are offended by this, I think. Hopefully it would be only the very fringe radical elements, I think, the ultra-extreme interpretationists within each of these major religious groups. They're probably not going to like even the suggestion of this sort of thing. But throughout the story, Tempe is equally as appalled at the idea, equally resistant to even considering this idea for a while.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm understanding this correctly, then is this striking a chord for the idea of science? Like, let's try to let the science, as we know the science now, try to suss out what the story is?
Well, it's striking a chord for science. It's also striking a chord, I think, against, and Tempe kind of goes into this in the closing passages, against extremist interpretations of institutionalized religion. Mm-hmm. That religion is supposed to, and the three quotes before the story begins, all taken from the Old Testament, the New Testament, Islamic scriptures, talking about peace. That if we don't have these extreme radical insistence upon one very narrow interpretation, and to the point where some groups actually get physically violent about it, that, you know, really what Scripture's saying is we should be working towards peace and living peacefully with each other.
Mm-hmm. The book is just out. Has there been any such reaction?
I haven't had any negative reaction as yet. I've had some pointed questions during radio interviews, but no negative, nothing negative as yet.
Mm-hmm. Would those questions be along the lines of that you're challenging biblical, at least in the from the Christian perspective?
Yeah. So how can you do this? You know, Jesus died on the cross and his body went up into heaven. Well, I'm not saying it didn't. I'm just making a fictional story about, well, what if these things took place? These facts, these archaeological, what if, you know, what if this took place?
And there seems to be a lot of that discussion out now, right?
Yes.
In the Da Vinci
yes.
Code and others
right.
of late, at least offering other interpretations.
Right.
Yeah. Your roots are in archaeology. Is this the first return you feel like you've made to that?
Actually, my second book, Death du Jour, was based on a case I did for the Catholic Church. I was asked to exhume and analyze the remains of a woman who died in 1714, who's now been proposed for sainthood. So that was kind of more of an historic archaeological.
Now, what did you have to find out in that case?
Well, she died in 1714. She was rather well known as a recluse, and she was supposedly buried in this old abandoned church. And as you read the first chapter of that, it's exactly as it took place. We're in this old church. It's freezing cold. It's the middle of winter. We get her, what they think is her.
Is this in Montreal?
In Montreal. Mm-hmm. We get what they think is Jean Lebert, was her name, get her coffin and take it back to the forensic lab, and we do a full analysis on the bones. So what they wanted to do is make sure, because her father was buried in there as well, they wanted to make sure that they had the right skeleton, because then it was reburied under the altar. So that was kind of an archaeological question. It was a lot of fun digging up the old documents pertaining to her, as well as digging up the bones themselves.
Did you have to do that DNA testing, the mitochondrial, to find out the family line?
Well, I don't know that there's anyone living today to whom we could have done a comparative study. Mm-hmm. So DNA in a vacuum doesn't, one of the earlier callers says, is it infallible? And that's one of the myths, I think, that CSI is perpetrating, is that DNA solves everything. But if you've got DNA in a vacuum, it really doesn't do you any good. You can submit it to a centralized data bank and see if you get a hit. But if not, your DNA sample just has to wait until you have a possible name. So in the case of someone that's been dead 2,000 years, as in my book, or dead 300 years, as in the case of this woman who's been proposed for sainthood, you know, if you have no living descendant to whom to compare it, then what are you going to do with it?
Did she get her sainthood?
I don't know that. I think it's a very long process, unless you're the Pope, of course. They can bump you to the front of the line. But the application was submitted to the Vatican.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you have also done work. You testified out at the UN Tribunal in over Rwanda,
right,
in the genocide there.
Right, right. What I did for the United Nations was similar to what I'd been doing for the military lab. I worked as an external consultant for our central identification lab over in Hawaii, where all of our war dead from Southeast Asia, Korea, and World War II are being identified. And anytime there's a positive ID of a serviceman, that whole file, that whole dossier has to be reviewed by an external reviewer. So I did that for years and then would travel to Hawaii to oversee the running of the lab twice a year. That's what I did for the United Nations. I didn't do the on-the-grounds work in Rwanda, but I took the entire dossier, the anthropology, the pathology, all of that material, and analyzed it and testified as to the competency and the quality of the work that was done. This involved a case in Kigali of a man that was accused of killing 23 people and burying them around the grounds of his garage in Kigali. So that was my role. And then I went to the tribunal and went to Africa and testified at the tribunal.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you.
And you are going to be appearing, making a reading tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh.
Quail Ridge at 7 o'clock.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Good luck with your book.
Bye-bye.
Kathy Rikes has been forensic anthropologist for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in North Carolina and in Quebec. Her newest novel is called Crossbones. And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, we welcome your email. Our address is sot@wunc.org. Our program is directed by Keith Weston and produced by Corey Princel and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. Dave DeWitt is the managing editor. And Susan Davis is the senior producer. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Penkava.